You'll make the grade. No time for last place, honey. Oh, honey. Now you won't know how to give yourself till somebody shows you what to do. You're tired of living on the same old shelf. Come on, honey, open up. I'm sure you're gonna see through. Said time's wasting, you got a chance. You'll make the grade. No time for last place, honey. Oh, honey.
We're live. It's a pleasure to be here with Bill Lustig here in West Hollywood.
Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. If it sounds like the Indianapolis 500, it's because we decided not to close the windows. It's too beautiful a day out.
No, it's been great seeing you again and catching up as usual. I found out actually this morning when I was looking over some notes that we both have a birthday coming up, and it's the same day.
Yeah.
Next week, right?
February 1st. Oh, my God. Oh, it's horrible. And they come by so fast, Steve. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. It just feels like yesterday I had my last birthday. I'm probably do what I do most years and hibernate for the day.
I mean, you know, on that note, February 1st is your birthday. Tell me a little bit about, you know, again, Tom, you know, where you were born, where you brought up. I know you live in L.A. now, but
I was born in Bronx, New York, and at age 7, my family moved to New Jersey, which at the time everybody in the Bronx was leaving town because the Puerto Ricans are coming, the blacks are coming. So they all went to New Jersey, Long Island, you know, they all split from the Bronx. And my family wound up in New Jersey, and we were right across the George Washington Bridge, so I was actually closer to Manhattan than I was living in the Bronx. And it was Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, and at the time we moved there were dirt roads. And coming from the Bronx, I thought dirt roads, this is country. And my first question was, can we get a horse? Yeah. I thought, this is it, it's cowboys. But it was fortunate because I was in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, when I did become interested in making movies, or actually first my interest in watching movies, I was close enough to Manhattan to be able to just get on a bus, head over the bridge, take the train to the village, mostly to West 4th Street or to 42nd Street, where I could get to see so many movies. I mean, at the time in the 60s, New York was a film buff's dream. We had art house repertory theaters almost in every neighborhood. It was amazing. I pity the people today, since all of that has gone away. You have occasional repertory theaters in New York. You have Film Forum, but in New York, there was a double feature at rep theaters like the Bleecker Street Cinema, the Carnegie Hall Cinema, the Thalia, the Symphony, the Beacon Street Cinema. I could go on and on with all of these places that you had all these options to see great movies on the big screen. And that's become much more limited today. But it was that experience, that immersion into the world of film, whether it's art house or Roger Corman exploitation, which I fell in love with. And I fell in love with movies, and it fueled my passion to direct.
You know, is there anything in your childhood growing up, and I'm talking about before you were 16, more like in your before you were 10, that essentially turned you on to these films or to eventually immersing yourself into this sort of counterculture, which has become your life, with just a regular upbringing in Englewood Cliffs, which is now one of the most desirable places, of course, to live. You know, it's like...
Yeah, my family bought the house for, I think it was 40 or 45,000, and this was in 62, and sold it in 2006 for about $1 million.
I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. Such amazing property. But yeah.
I would have to say, I think what kind of helped or pushed me into film was I have a childhood, I have muscular dystrophy. And as a result, when I was younger, I was limited in my walking. And so going to the movies was something I was able to do. And so I'm looking back, I have to say, I think that was really the impetus for me to be able to see so many movies. I also found myself distant from my friends, or I should really say people of my own age group. I didn't have many friends growing up. Because I really wasn't interested in being in school. I kind of like found school to be disinteresting to me at the time. I really wasn't, I really wanted to make movies, and I kept thinking about it and gravitating towards that. So it kind of gave me a kind of a focus early on, and I skipped my Porky years, where I just sort of went from, you know, from going to school to being a full-fledged businessman making movies. And in fact, produced and directed my first film when I was 21, but had prior to that worked on many films for 4 or 5 years before that.
Which of course, I'm going to ask you about. On that same note of getting into, you know, middle school and high school in somewhat suburban New Jersey, I also grew up in Jersey, and I remember trying to sneak into the city as much as I could. And of course, after a while, your parents become accustomed to it. Were there obstacles for you, or it was as simple as just, you know, getting right over the GWB and you were in a mecca? I mean, essentially feeding your addiction, if you will.
The school I went to, Dwight Morrow High School in Englewood, New Jersey. There was this long driveway, and along the driveway, there were these old trees. And I would take the school bus to school, and I would arrive, and I would say to myself, today I'm going to go to school, today I'm going to go to school. And I just would get there, and I would say, fuck it. And I did a thing, or I felt like I was Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, where I would head down this driveway, hiding behind the trees, going from tree to tree, making it to the last tree. That when I started to see the bus come to the bus stop, I made this dash as though there were going to be Germans open firing on me with machine guns from that last tree to the bus, and that's how I would get on that bus and see and breathe a sigh of relief. As I headed into the city.
It's amazing. That's amazing.
So that was my obstacle.
Oh, that was your obstacle. Of course, you know, it's safe to say that this love for film and exploitation and just these oddities and all kinds of amazing alternate type of motion pictures.
But I was as much interested in the French New Wave as I was in those kinds of movies. It really was very diverse. I can't begin to tell you all the movies that I saw theatrically. I saw the Truffaut Fellini films, the Godard films, sometimes the same day as I would see Bloodthirsty Butchers. You know, it was to me, film was film, and I would say probably I was less interested in things that would be like Bible epics and things like that. Never really interested me. I was not a fan of those kind of movies, but I was pretty much everything else.
And you know, people say Bill Lustig, and I've known you for several years now. I hear Peter Savage, Taxi Driver, Jake LaMotta, yeah. Raging Bull, Blue Underground. You're essentially this umbrella of a story, and I don't want to undo it. But can you give me a little background?
The person who I credit with taking me serious as to wanting to make films was Peter Savage, whose real name was Peter Petrilla. And at the time, his productions had gone from being these kind of, I don't know, wishy-washy. I wouldn't even call them exploitation films. They were kind of movies that aspired to be something, and they really kind of fell short, whether it was a comedy or a drama. They never really worked. And in the early 70s, it became the porn gold rush. Everybody was moving to do a porn. Deep Throat fueled this thing that, you know, there's gold in those and porn. So Pete was starting to make, I think he just made his first one. I think I worked on his first one called Hypnerotica, and that was in 72. And
it was just, did you know him beforehand?
Oh, yeah. No, he was a child. He was somebody growing up. He was best friends with my Uncle Jake. And so he was always at family gatherings and things like that. And I would pull him aside and talk about movies. But we were of two different generations, and the kinds of films that I was in love with, of course, he found, like, how could you think of that? I remember coming back. I remember going to Pete's office after seeing Texas Chainsaw Massacre on its second day of its release on 42nd Street. And I came to Pete's office and I go, I just saw the greatest movie. It was unbelievable. And I was raving and raving. And he's there reading the New York paper and he goes, what are you talking about? Look, the Daily News, it got 0 stars. So, you know, we didn't quite see eye to eye, you know? And I think it was a generational thing, you know?
But he accepted you in
a
big way.
He did. He saw my passion. Yep. And because he saw me so passionate, I had dropped out of high school to work in film. And Pete said to me one day, sat me down, he said, look, you're serious about making movies. You should go to NYU like Martin Scorsese. He says, that's what you should do. So Pete very generously opened his checkbook. When I went to NYU, I met with the head of the film department, the legendary Haig Manoogian, and I got Haig Manoogian's blessing to get into the film program. And I went to Pete when I said, it's going to cost like $900 for me to go for one semester to film school. And he opened his checkbook and he cut a check to New York University.
That's amazing.
For my tuition. And he cut it for the second semester. And
so can it be safe to say it was like Uncle Pete?
He was as close to me as any of my uncles, if not more. He did more for me than anybody. I mean, there was nobody in my life who gave me such amazing encouragement. I mean, really sincere encouragement.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. You always need somebody. To help already feed that creative fuel that's going on.
Yeah. I mean, and we didn't see eye to eye on anything. You know, it was like so funny because we were, you know, but what made me very proud in later years, just by chance, how it happened, I don't know. But in Pete's local cinema theater in Long Island, when my movie Maniac opened, it said on the marquee, William Lustig's Maniac. And Pete never got over that. That my name was on a marquee at a Long Island theater. I didn't know anybody at the theater. I didn't know why that was up there. I had no celebrity. But to Pete's eyes, I had risen. So after that, we were at the Cannes Film Festival together when Raging Bull was going to premiere there, which Pete is credited as produced in association with. And I felt as though we had become colleagues, and we've become, he had a respect for me.
It broke free of that relationship. Now you were equal in a sense, and it was tough for him to swallow seeing.
Well, it wasn't. It really wasn't. He wasn't resentful
or
anything.
Proud.
He was proud. But it was funny because he talked to me differently. It was a different thing. If I said something, he wasn't finding a way to disparage what I was saying. He was no longer holding up the Daily News and showing me the review for Texas Chainsaw Massacre at 0 stars.
In a sense,
stars.
It sounds like you graduated.
I graduated. And it was a fun time. I'll never forget it. And he died right after that.
But it was
amazing.
Before you started taking courses, were you working as a PA?
Yes.
Were you holding cables?
I got into NYU, it might have been 75 or 74, but I had been working in the film business for probably 3 or 4 years as various things, PA, production assistant, also as editing. as an apprentice editor. I worked quite a bit as an apprentice editor. That was sort of my MO. At some point, they put me on a school work program where I would go to high school from like 8 in the morning until noon. And then I would work at a place in New York called Film Right. And I would arrive there sometime between 1 and 2 and work until sometimes all night.
Sounds like a co-op program.
It was a way the school kind of, they took out all my gym classes and all that and just said,
it's like vocation school for film, but still getting your regular education.
Yeah. And they, you know, look, at a time when there were race riots in our neighborhood, and there were all kinds of problems, you go to your guidance counselor and you're talking about your love of wanting to make movies and you're going to work as an apprentice editor. It's music to their ears. You're not looking out, you're not going in to sell dope. And so they embraced my passion and gave
help,
me the
help feed it. Courage. That's wonderful. Yeah. That's really wonderful. Working for different people, when you were going to film school, is it true that the first films that you made were these X-rated films that you really made as your directorial debut, if you will?
They were my feature film debut. A Violation of Claudia I made, I was 21. I had cobbled together about $15,000. It wound up costing a bit more than that because I was learning as I was going along, so I wasn't as cost efficient as I should have been. And I made that with, I had a group of three investors in New Jersey, and they put up $5,000 each, and I went out and made the movie. And it was a great learning experience, because I did everything. I produced it, directed it, I probably wrote most of it, and I edited it myself, and I wound up distributing it with the help of your father.
Sure, sure. You sort of already mentioned it. A lot of filmmakers were finding this Deep Throat opened up this, you know, this highway of sort of everything's essentially acceptable. They didn't have to have white coders anymore, exploitation. People could now do it all. Did you make an X-rated or an adult film because it was you knew you'd be able to make it? You knew it was something that, you know, there was, you could sort of...
Well, it was what I could raise money to make. You know,
well, how can exploitation film low budget?
Well, because the entry level to make an adult film is a lot less than making an exploitation film. It's just that simple. And so for $15,000, I can go out and shoot an adult movie. I couldn't have done that if I wanted to make a decent horror film. And plus, there was an interest. Because with adult films were almost considered to be fuck up proof. You know, even if I made a bad adult film, as long as there was some hardcore sex in it, it had a marketability at some level. Versus if you make a horror film and don't do it very well, you still have a possibility of getting maybe something, but maybe not. And so that was the reason.
You were obviously already in the industry, essentially being around Peter, seeing him make erotic films. You know,
well, I knew all the people. You knew all the players.
That's what I was going to ask you. How did you go ahead and cast it? Of course, we're talking about Sharon Mitchell and Jamie Gillis.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
and
I knew there was a casting agent.
Let me guess, Dorothy Palmer.
Of course, the legendary Dorothy Palmer. Her office was at 250 West 57th Street, the Fisk Building, above Yangtze River Chinese Restaurant, which is no longer there. And Dorothy Palmer was this middle-aged woman. I don't know if she's still alive.
Yeah, I believe she is. Everyone talks about her.
Right,
because she was everybody, whether it be Metzger, whether it be where she got, everybody came from Dorothy Palmer. It's almost a going gag. You know, let me guess, Dorothy Palmer, that's, you know.
Yeah, and...
So she gave you a list of the repertory players,
She had books, and she had Polaroids, and you know, all kinds of stuff. And then when you would choose, they, you know, often she'd bring the people in. I was kind of embarrassed. I mean, I was 21 years old. I wasn't a virgin, but I wasn't, an adventurous sexual guy at 21
pretty
years
straight,
old.
Pretty straight.
You know, I was, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, it was, I wasn't promiscuous or anything. And so she brought people in, and I was very timid. But I found the people I liked. What's so funny is like somebody like Sharon Mitchell, she was attractive, But more importantly, I was enchanted by her personality. And it's funny because that's what I responded most to. So, you know, that's kind of how I cast.
Years back.
By the way, you didn't ask me the question how I came up with the name Billy Bag.
Oh.
I was driving an auto parts truck before I was doing auto parts delivery for a Napa auto parts place in Tenafly, New Jersey. And what happened is when they would hand me dirty auto parts, I would say, I'm not going to put my hands up. Put it in a bag. Put it in a bag. And I would always tell them that. You know, you want me to bring these spark plugs, you know, put them in a bag and I'll carry it. I'm not going to go. And so my nickname at the place was Billy Bag.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because I never wanted to get my hands dirty.
Oh, that's great. That's great. You are a neat guy.
So I didn't want to put my name on it, but I wanted the guys, for whatever reason, I wanted to impress the guys who owned the gas stations and my colleagues in Tenafly, New Jersey.
They probably thought you were a guy.
Because they would have porno. They would have Saturday afternoon beer and porno at the auto parts store. They would run porno films, you know, 8mm pornos with beer, and they would invite all the local owners of the gas stations.
I mean, they were essentially a little local hero. You were making films for these guys, essentially.
They were like astonished that I actually was like, you know.
The guy driving the auto part truck is just shooting porn.
And I was also reading Variety, which also made them. When I was driving an auto parts truck, when I wasn't driving and I was waiting for the next delivery, I'd have my Variety that I would read.
Filmed.
And they would look at me like, you know, what is he, nuts?
Really, really briefly, I have a little bit of insight into, you know, your what you had done with those films as far as distribution. You know, you made these films, you shot them, you had a few investors. What'd you do then? You struck some prints? How did you get it into theaters?
What happened is very simple. Your father and Howie
DistroPix
had just taken over the lease for the World Theater on 49th Street. They had a movie called Inside Jennifer Wells, but it wasn't ready to open. So I was their very first release in June of 1977 when their lease began. I was their very, very first release was my film. And my film played 7 weeks there until Inside Jennifer Wells
was ready
to be released. And
that sounds, that's pretty. That's a pretty cool story. That's a pretty cool fact.
Well, it's true.
That's what I mean.
And I don't know if they had another film, they would have put my film in. I can't say for sure, but it was. I opened at the Radio City Music Hall of Porn, the World Theater, which was the primo place. And once you opened your film at the World Theater, all the other theaters around the country. We immediately gave your film the cloak of an important film, a film of distinction. So it opened the doors of all the other important theaters, including the Pussycat Chain and in California and all
exactly
of that.
Exactly verbatim. Most of the people I talked to or interviewed, Radley Metzger, same exact thing he used to say. And if it opened at the World, Miranda took notice out west, and you could write your ticket. You know, if it opened up at the World, it didn't almost matter. If it opened at the World,
well, the World became the gatekeeper. It became the arbiter of what was the best in the country. And funny enough, though, the Rialto Theater that was owned by Bingo Brandt, which was on 42nd Street, had an entrance on 7th, which gave it distinction, had two entrances, actually. It was a theater that was more of a grindhouse, and you could make more money at the Rialto, but it didn't give you that same cloak as the World did. So the World was always the first attempt, and if you missed out on the World, then the next step would be, say, the Rialto, and if the Rialto, for whatever reason, was a problem, then maybe you would go into the Circus or some of those other theaters.
Gotcha.
But the World was the one to aim for. And that, of course, allowed the film to make a little bit.
And that's what I was going to ask. So that's actually a great break. I guess it was a great break for Artie and Howard because they got a pretty decent film. And they also gave you a shot in the sense that this was your first film.
I was also, because it was my first film and because I had money tied up, I had investor money that I was desperate to get back to them. And I had cost overruns, and so I had outstanding bills. I owed people money. I owed labs and things money. I I probably would have done it anyway, but I was a relentless marketeer. What I would do is, as an example, before the movie opened at the World, I printed up a lot of trailers, and I went around to even the World competitors that weren't owned, you know, wasn't a theaters controlled by your dad. I went to theaters like the Eros on 8th Avenue.
Capri, Eros.
All these places. And what I would do is I'd get in, somehow they would let me in, and I would go up to the projection booth, and I would hand the trailer and $20 to the projectionist, and it would actually have at the end of the trailer, coming soon to the World Theater. And none of the owners of these theaters evidently ever watched the trailers that were running.
They would have been pissed
theaters.
You were promoting another theater.
I'm promoting another theater. And
That's brilliant.
And I just gave the projectionist $20. Then the other thing I thought about is across from the World, there was I think it was Gray Line Tours, and they had an office directly across from the World on 49th Street. And I made up flyers for the movie. It was like something, I use words to effect, see the most talked about adult film in New York, okay? And I took these flyers and I dropped them off, not only at that Gray Line, but I went around to one on 54th Street. There was a tour bus office there. Any place that tourists went that I could just drop off flyers, I dropped off flyers for the picture because I wanted to get tourists in there. We ran it for all the critics. Al Goldstein, who's no longer with us, the late Al Goldstein, denies this, but it's true. I invited him to a screening of the picture. Al Goldstein demanded that he would be the film. He would go only to a screening that it was just for him. And he'd bring some of his, sluts with him. But it was just a screening for him. You couldn't have any other people in there because Screw Magazine was so important. So I went to the screening when Al Goldstein was there, and I put $500 in an envelope, and I handed it to Al Goldstein, and I said, I hope you enjoy the movie. And I wound up getting, I think it was 98% or something on his Peter meter. I have it someplace.
I think we have it too.
I got some, credible, review.
It was very important that his quotes and his reviews
very
were everything.
It Screw was, Magazine was the Wall Street Journal of the adult business.
That's right.
And anybody, would go to it. And so they were a tastemaker. And
that's right.
I had to be able to bribe the tastemaker.
That's right.
Al Goldstein. It's kind of hilarious today, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
So I did everything possible, and the film did well at the World, and it did well around the country.
You struck lots of prints. You started being your own theatrical agent. I mean, is that literally how you did
it? Yeah, well, what happened is there was a lab that's no longer in existence.
Which one was that?
It was a publicly owned lab. It was called Cinefex. And it was publicly owned. So all the employees were raping the company. I would go in, and I was buying my prints at the time for $350 each. What I would do is, I would order, say, 10 prints, 35 millimeter prints of Violation of Claudia. I'd pull up in my Buick Electra, which can be seen in Maniac. It became Joe Spinell's car, and it never worked the same, and I got rid of it after Maniac. But it was the Maniac car. I'd open this gigantic trunk that you could probably fit about 10 bodies in. And I would load it up, that in the back seat with prints.
Car would be all down to the ground.
It would be down to the ground. I was scraping, and I would meet them. I would literally drive up around 6 in the afternoon on Friday, and they would bring down the prints in boxes, and I would load them into the car, and I'd give them the $3,500 for the 10 prints in cash, and that's how I was getting my prints. It was so funny. Your father and Howie, before we opened, I had a meeting with them at their office on 54th Street. It's 54th, right? 54th. And they said to me, if there is less than 15 people that buy tickets. The box office opens at 9:45. The first show is at 10. If there's less than 15 people, you're getting pulled. I was in front of the World Theater across the street, so they wouldn't, so nobody would see me. I was across the street with one of those runner counters, and I'm counting the people buying tickets to come in to the theater, and my eyes were focused like a laser on the box office. And off to my left comes, and I didn't see them until they were maybe a foot away from me, was your father and Howie looking at me, counting the people coming
on a counter.
On a counter. And I had it like down on my side, you know, because I was trying to be, you know. And they looked at me and go, what are you doing?
Ensuring I don't get pulled from you. Yeah. I have to go buy 10 tickets, I'll buy 10 tickets. Oh, that was great. That's great.
So that was it. They saw me over there. I was so funny.
Were they? I mean, you know, of course, I hear lots of stories. They were all right to do a deal with. They were all right. You know,
oh yeah, it worked out fine.
Yep.
It was very good. Another funny thing is I thought I was Stanley Kubrick, and when I would get these prints from the lab, I brought them over to the World Theater because I wanted to check them before I shipped them. Now, nobody in their right mind would do this. So I would give the print to the projectionist, and I'd say, would you mind, back then they were still doing things on reels, separate reels. There weren't the platter system. So replacing a print for the next show wasn't such a big deal because all they would do is just take the reels from the box and they would put them up. It was six of one, half a dozen or another. But I wanted to check, so I'd give them the print, and I'd go down, and I'd watch the print to check quality control. And one time, I was down there checking, and suddenly the picture started to go off the screen to the right, and I'm suddenly seeing half the picture. I run up to the projection booth, and I'm witnessing my print, this brand new print from the lab, the reel being cut right in half. And I'm looking, and there's the projectionist, and he's putting on his shirt. It was the end of his shift and to go home. And I'm seeing the projector literally cutting my print, and half the print is falling, is gathering
just
in a
spot. Slicing to the side.
It's just right gathering a big ball of print. It's being sliced right in half, and the other half is getting in the.
That $350 is just being thrown away.
Well, it was just one reel of it.
I know.
But I go. Oh my God. And the projectionist goes over and he stops and, you know, and he didn't give a shit. He just goes over to the next, puts on the next reel, you know. So what if the customer missed like 10 minutes of the movie? It doesn't matter. And the guy is going, oh, I'm really sorry. I go, you fuck. And I start, and now remember, I'm now 22. I'm a 22-year-old guy yelling at probably a guy in his 50s, you know, a veteran Broadway projectionist. And I am yelling at him. And I'm saying, you moron, I paid. How did you do this to me? You know, I totally lost it and said things that I shouldn't have said. Next thing you know, I get a call. It was from a guy named Frank D'Alessio, who worked for your father. Okay? And it was a call that said...
He worked for the theaters, right?
Yeah.
Theater guy.
He was the manager. Yep. The managers. And he always had his briefcase. The old-fashioned briefcase. And I always used to think he had a gun in there and he had cash. That was his... Anyway, I get a call that said, I heard you had a situation with the projectionist at the theater. My suggestion is that you get a bottle of scotch... And you go back to the theater today and you apologize. And I said, well, you know, the guy was wrong. And I was, you know, I was young. I was a little stupid. Yep. And he said, do you want every one of your prints to be destroyed?
The projectionist had a lot more power than you would think, right? I mean,
yeah.
These guys, you know.
So I took his advice. I went there. I bought a bottle of scotch. The projectionist goes, oh, you didn't have to do this. Oh, I apologize. Oh, yeah, no, don't, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I squared it away, you know. I was stupid. Put it on myself.
Sure,
and
sure.
The guy goes, these things happen. You know, sometimes they come from the lab and they're not good. And You know, you hear all that stuff. Oh, yeah, exactly. yeah. Anyway, that was my...
That's great. Great memory. You know, obviously, again, there's a lot more detail because you have done, you know, you've done full length commentaries for both these films. And of course, we'll talk at the end just real quickly about who you did them with. But soon thereafter, you made Violation. You went on to make another film.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, what happened was after Violation of Claudia, I had taken the film around, a 16 millimeter print of the film, and showed it to all the then exploitation distributors, producers in New York.
People, can you throw some out there?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you. Lou Mishkin and William Mishkin. I took it to Dan Kennis and Sam Sherman at Independent International. I took it to a guy named Joe Green, Joseph Green. And
all theatrical players.
Yeah, there was a guy, Brenner. I took it to
Joseph Brenner.
Yep. I took it to God. There was so many at the time. All characters, by the way. There was a guy by the name who did Cry Uncle, and I can't think of his name right now. He was an interesting guy. He also produced Lee Hessel. Yep. Boy, you're good.
Yeah.
Lee Hessel.
Yeah.
That was Lee Hessel. Anyway, Nick Demetrolis, all these people.
Even the Greeks, the Cosmos guys, Teddy and Tommy.
I didn't take it to them. Well, really what I was trying to do is these are people who were involved with horror films. And I wanted to make a horror film. So I took it around as my directorial sample. And what I basically got from all of them, well, you can do porn, but how do we know you can work with actors on a regular movie? And I kind of was frustrated because I just was getting this kind of reaction. What I didn't really know is they were having financial trouble and they weren't really making films as much as they used to make them. They were mostly operating as distributors and in many cases of tax shelter movies that were coming out of Europe at the time. So they really weren't the active people they were in the 60s. And this was now the mid to late 70s. So, but I took it to heart and I said, God, you know, I really thought I did a really good job on this movie, but it wasn't good enough. And I was still driving an auto parts truck. And I was feeling...
Distributing the movies at the same time?
Yeah, from my childhood bedroom in New Jersey. I was feeling kind of depressed. And I had finally paid back my investors. And I had accumulated, I think it was like $7,000 or $8,000 for myself.
From the picture, from Violation.
From Violation of Claudia. And I remember this was almost a year after releasing it. And
You paid the investors.
And so what happened is I then quit my auto parts job and I decided the only thing I could do is make another porn. And I did it not happily. I did it with the idea that, you know, it really doesn't matter if you have a cute title and a good ad campaign, you know. Any shit sells, no one cares. So when I went to do Hot Honey, I did it without the enthusiasm I had when I did Violation of Claudia. I did it because I had no other resources to do anything else. So I made Hot Honey for a grand total of $15,000, $7,000 or $8,000, all my own money. I had enough money to shoot it, and the rest was with the labs who had already paid back, so they were willing to extend me credit. Same thing with the equipment house, they were willing to extend me credit, and I made Hot Honey.
It sounds like it was almost essentially, you know, just another Violation of Claudia, but not as happy.
It was a lower, I made the film in 3 days versus Violation of Claudia. I spent a ridiculous 7 days.
Right, and Violation was 35 millimeter.
Yes.
Hot Honey was 16. So you had a whole different in just the source material.
By the way, I learned something else by later shooting 16, that in the end it winds up costing the same, if not more, than 35. That it really wasn't a cost.
Was that because of the blow-ups?
Because of the blow-up factor. And
who would do that? How many labs even did at the time? Is it true that it was just Duart? I mean, who really, or not Duart? I mean, was
Duart was the one that was in the mainstream, but they weren't doing porn. It was I went to an optical house, the name I forget, but it was Synopticals. They did the blow up on Hot and Honey. They also later did the blow up on Maniac. But they, so anyway, I did that picture.
It wasn't happy. It wasn't as good of an experience,
yeah,
a happy experience.
I mean, it had some, you know, I opened at the Rialto. You know, Bingo Brandt was a character to deal with. And it went out and it did what it was supposed to do. It had Serena, who was a big star, and Jamie, you know, those were the people, those were the key people in it, and shot Hot Honey, I believe it was April or May of 78.
So you were very busy. I mean, you were, in essence, you really didn't sit, really sit back that long until you made another movie.
Well,
saying.
Because I wanted to keep going. I wanted to make movies. And the checks were coming in on violation, so you know it was a good time to do.
So these two films that you had made and around the circuit, you were known as Billy Bag.
Yes,
like people knew you as Billy Bag.
Yeah, I was known as Billy Bag.
Billy Bag.
And then I was determined to do a horror film. And a year later, I had at this point gotten back my money, and I had saved up about $30,000. And Joe Spinell had $6,000 that he had just made on cruising. And my childhood friend Andrew Garoni had $12,000. So with a grand total of $48,000, we went out and shot Maniac.
It's unbelievable. Which to this day it's a franchise, essentially.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Were you, after you made Hot Honey, you had Violation of Claudia and Hot Honey as these Billy Bag films, certainly, and again, I may be wrong, you could have gone on and probably continued to make porn films. It just, you know,
it was a different time. The porn business was really going through the waning period. It wasn't the go-go years of the early 70s. It really became...
It was the downslide of porno chic.
It was
now the raincoaters started to come in. It was just as things started to...
It was the downside. It was starting to... it was the beginning of the end of the theatrical.
It was the theatrical death roll, for
yeah.
sure, for sure.
Yeah.
And that, of course, accompanied with the fact that maybe Hot Honey wasn't exactly what you essentially wanted to do. You were certain now you knew what kind of film you wanted to make.
Yeah, I remember screening it for your father and Howie, and their criticism. I made a comment about doing some improvement on the film, and your father very indelicately said to me while he was munching on a corned beef sandwich that I paid for, says to me, "Well, that would be like giving Frankenstein a nose job."
Oh, God, it's so typical.
Yes. Yeah, when you screened for your father and Howie, I had to have deli sandwiches in the screening room. That was part of the deal.
It's too much. But you did, in essence, beforehand, working with Peter. You worked around the industry.
I worked on several pornos, including the one Sylvia, which is quite famous. And in that world, and there was one, as I said, Hypnerotica, there was a couple of others. I even shot a gay porn, and I was hired on it, and I didn't know it was a gay porn until I came on the set.
You don't remember the name by chance?
I do. It was called Headmaster. How can I forget that name? Also starring Jamie Gillis.
No, he did it all.
He was versatile.
He did it all.
And it was directed and produced by Jason Russell.
Yep. Famous, as Tina's husband, but also a big figure in that golden era. Brought a lot of people in. Just to swing over and sort of make this a full circle, I got a chance to see some screenings several years ago, accompany you to some screenings of your own films. Vigilante was one of them that I remember mostly, Maniac as well. And I got a chance to you cordially invited me out to a wonderful meal before a screening at the New Beverly a few years ago, and it was just real quick. You did the Q&A the movie started. We went over to eat, but it wasn't just me and you. We got to eat with the whole cast, with Robert Forrester, Fred Williamson, Joe Pesci, and of course Frank Pesci and Joe Pesci, Frank Pesci, and of course you get to sit and listen, and it really was an honor to see the camaraderie over all these years. And of course you guys have stories that could fill books, just amazing. What has that whole resurgence, it's like I said, it's a franchise. Some of these films you made, to this day, you see them on cable, they're playing all over the place, they're getting grindhouse play. What does that all mean to you now? I mean, you made these two porno films, you went on to then make what you wanted to make, but they hit.
It was every time you make a movie, it's like a declaration of war. I don't care how big or small the movie is. It's you against the world to get that movie completed. It's just that simple. And when you work with people and you're the general, as the director, producer, you're the general, and they're following you to war, and it turns out to be successful, it's a camaraderie and a feeling that you guys all went through this and it turned out well. And so they have a respect for you because it turned out well, and they all look back with, you know, at the experience of going through that, you know, but would they look back happily because it was all for the end? Well, obviously, when you're doing a movie like, say, Vigilante, where you know, you have Screen Actors Guild actors and things like that, you can't do things as roughly as you could when, you know, went back when. But, you know, it was, it's everything has its own challenges. I mean, you know, I remember Joe Spinell and Frank Pesce visiting the set of Violation of Claudia, and we're all at in this apartment building, and the crew and myself are in the hallway outside the door of the apartment where inside we were shooting. And Joe Spinell comes and goes, "Well, what are you all here?" You know, and everybody's whispering outside. I said, "We're waiting for the actor to get an erection." Now, every movie has its own challenges. I don't recall having to do that when we were doing Maniac and Vigilante. You know? So, you know, in those movies, it was like Maniac. Well, we have to reset and clean up the blood because, you know, because we have to redo the, because the special effects didn't quite work, you know? Those were the, you know, so every movie has its own challenges, whether it's waiting for erections on adult movies or cleaning up blood on Maniac or setting up a stunt on Vigilante. All movies have their own challenges, and it's how you deal with them.
Like, how does it feel knowing that some of these movies that, you know, essentially were some of your earlier, you know, your earlier films, 35 years later, I mean, are still, you can't keep them on stock on Blu-ray and DVD. There's screens all over the place. I mean, what is that
tonight,
like?
Tonight, in an hour and 15 minutes from now, one of my movies is playing on FearNet. Two, back-to-back, on Saturday night.
And again, is it just an ultimately gratifying
it
feeling?
It is. I get a kick out of it. When I see my movie, it starts at 5 in L.A. and plays 8 o'clock, which is prime time in on the East Coast. Two of my movies, Maniac Cop 2 and 3, are playing on FearNet. I'm very proud of that, that they still entertain people, that they're not being given some late-night ghetto time slot of, say, 3 in the morning, but being played prime time on a network
station. For the last year, though, I don't know if it was Cinemax or Showtime. But
Showtime.
Showtime. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I see Cop 2, Maniac Cop 2.
Well, my films, how many films do you see are under license for as long as my films have been under license? They continually, so that says that they must be getting viewership. And the one thing I've always told people is B-movies tend to have a longer longevity than A-movies. I mean, I use an example of in May of 1980, two movies were released by Paramount Pictures, Ordinary People and Friday the 13th. What film, Ordinary People went on to win Best Picture of the Year, and Friday the 13th is the one that people continue to watch today, and no one gives a shit about Ordinary People.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And then, of course, with the resurgence in the popularity of grindhouse cinema and retro and things coming back, you've, of course, rode that wave as well, in the sense that recently Maniac was remade.
Yes.
Successful?
It was. It was successful. I believe it was profitable. I don't really know. I haven't received any accounting, but I was led to believe it was successful for the financiers, especially because of foreign sales. It played to it did very well on VOD in this country.
This is Elijah, the version.
Elijah Wood, IFC distributed it in the States, and I understand the VOD on it was pretty substantial. And But it's a different world. The climate has changed. Movies like the Maniac remake don't get the big theatrical releases as they did back then. Everything is almost kind of like people are watching these things at home. They're watching them on mostly on VOD now. Video on demand
becoming
is
the
big.
New. Yeah.
Is become the big. It's become the theatrical.
Yep.
For these kinds of movies.
Yep. Essentially, you have to adapt. You know, you have to adapt, or you get swallowed. And then of course, you know, there's another little small piece to as many other pieces to the picture. But once these movies started to come out, you started to make films. The 80s started to move. You know, we started to come through the 80s. Eventually, you know, in a layman's terms, I mean, you essentially became sort of, you know, synonymous with home video. You know, almost like, you know, home video re-releasing, getting these things out from the theater back on home video. Can you give me a real quick...
I'll give you a quick one. There was a format that is that most people will not remember called Laserdisc. It's so funny how quickly DVD caused it to disappear.
Can you sort of just explain it?
It was an LP size disc. Yes. That held video, and it was an analog format, not digital, and it was actually it was a digital, but it was analog tape that went to it, not digital tape, and it was the state of the art for a moment in time in the early 90s, the state of the art of watching movies, and I have of course a closet full of them, and I was a fan, and I wanted to. I was frustrated because the films that I wanted to see on Laserdisc weren't available, and if they were available, you'd have to get them from Japan, where it was like an enormous amount of money to get these imports. Yeah, yeah. I'm talking like you would pay $300-$400.
Yeah, it's like
each.
Getting a rare Japanese bootleg. It's like the same thing. It was
ridiculous. So I became proactive. I went out. I traveled to Europe because of my work. I was still directing. I was still involved with film, and I would when I would do a trip, if someone flew me, let's say, to Italy for a film festival, I'd go off and talk to sales agents, and I began to acquire movies with the intent of putting them on a Laserdisc. And then my big deal. I started with like Zombie and movies like that and Daughters of Darkness.
Essentially, the scenario classic. Was movies you loved.
Movies I loved.
You loved. Movies that you couldn't see, you know, you couldn't find on...
I was being proactive so I could watch the films I wanted to see. So eventually, I found a package of films, Hammer Films, which I bought. It was like 22 movies. And
Hammer Archives.
Yeah, famous Hammer Horror Films. Yep. And... and I put them out, and through Anchor Bay Entertainment, which I created a relationship with Jay Douglas, who was running the company at the time. And Jay comes to me one day and he says, you know, DVD is going to wipe out all of this. I've seen demonstrations. DVD is the future. It's going to make all of this go away. VHS and Laserdisc was all going to go bye-bye.
VHS, Beta, Laserdisc, yep.
And sure enough, of course, we know that Jay was right.
It happened quick.
And it happened very quick. Because there was such a dramatic jump in quality between VHS and DVD, it became quickly adaptable. Also, the economy was very good at the time. And... so there were several factors that created this incredible growth of the DVD format. And I became less interested in directing movies. I was making movies, but I kind of felt it was more of a job than it was something I was really passionate about. And so I sort of segued into producing DVDs, including all the bonus materials and stuff for Anchor Bay. And eventually, when Anchor Bay was put kind of on the sales block, I started Blue Underground, and that was it. And I've been doing it ever since.
It's incredible, incredible. You're responsible for bringing lots of movies to new formats.
Yeah,
that we would never probably have on these.
Well, I was first in.
Yeah,
it was first in, so I had a lot of good titles in my catalog, and it worked out quite well.
We had gotten together a few years back in Burbank, And you were gracious enough to have this idea of doing, you know, these commentaries, you know, because you're just such a character. And there was another person that was involved. Can you introduce him?
Well, let me explain. four or 5 years, Nick and I shared an apartment in New York.
Nick Winding Refn,
director of Drive, the Pusher trilogy, Only God Forgives, Bronson.
Prolific young director.
Yeah, Valhalla Rising. Yep.
Very prolific.
Yeah, and I'll never forget this. We're walking, it's snow. There was snow on the ground, and we're walking through the East Village, and he turns and he says to me, "Why haven't you put your adult movies out on Blu-ray? When are you going to put them out?" And I said, "Nick, I said, I don't own them. I was before I really met you. And I said, I don't own the films, and what happened, it's yesterday's news. I don't own them anymore." And he says, "Well, you know, if you ever put them out," he goes, "I'll do a commentary with you on them." And sure enough, I found you. And
I think something in you was burning to seek me out at that point, because, you know, you
were Nick.
Well,
I mean, wasn't really my primary reason. you had an interest in doing it. And Nick was in town. He was shooting the movie Drive. And one Saturday, we went in and recorded the audio commentaries for both pictures.
Which are incredibly entertaining. Incredibly. I think Nick had a little bit of his a fun time with you.
Let's just say.
It's like,
well, Nick and I always have fun. You know, he's the artist. And I, and we always kid each other. And, and he always kind of takes it a little seriously sometimes. But we had fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun recording it. I don't remember it, but I assume if you tell me it's good, it's good.
It's good. Very informational, very entertaining, and of course you remain very friendly with Nick and potentially maybe doing some future projects.
Yeah, we're working right now on the Maniac remake, Maniac Cop remake, I should say, not Maniac, Maniac Cop. We're working on that right now on the script.
That's amazing.
And it's
exciting.
It's exciting.
You know, have a guy like that. A movie like this,
it is.
I'm excited
for fun.
You. I'm excited for you. So that's great. I mean, I just want to say that Violation of Claudia and Hot Honey will be coming out, you know, soon.
I hope so. It's been a while since we recorded.
And all the fans will be able to get a chance to hear you guys talk, hear Nick have fun with you, hear you talk about all the facts and stuff that went on. And it's been a great teaser. You know, this is great. Nothing crazy was given away, so the fans have plenty to look forward to. And,
I will say one thing. When I record audio commentaries, I try to talk to the person who wants to know about the nuts and bolts of movies, and to the best of my ability, I try to remain honest with the process. Because I've only learned from people who are honest with me, and I don't want to waste people's time unless I can educate them on what the process is of doing these films.
Yeah, it definitely, believe me, as editing too, I'm cutting this stuff together. It is the essence of these commentaries. I mean, that's what's beautiful about it. We don't really, just want have a conversation. How are you doing? What were you thinking? A lot of these times, these are for the fans. This is what makes them rebuy these packages. They want to know, what was it like on 16? What was it like doing this? What was it like doing the blow up? And at the same time that you get all that info and all this technical stuff, you have Nick essentially, again, and I'm being somewhat facetious here, you know, busting your chops on how the hell this guy who made this Maniac and a Cop and Vigilante this franchise start off making these, you know, these essentially lower budget, you know, erotic films. So it was really well done, and I look forward to their release.
Thank you. And
anything that we can, you know, do going forward to help promote them, we will. And it's been an honor to talk to you. It's really, you're a legend, and it really has just completed a dream of mine to be able to.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. You must release Kinky Ladies of Bourbon Street,
and I
expect people who hear this to send to make calls and send emails, pushing him to release what I consider to be my favorite adult film of all time.
I will remember that, and I will oblige.
All right.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Take
pleasure.
Care.
Thank you, my friend.
You got a chance. You'll make the grade. No time for last place, honey. Now you won't know how to give yourself till someone has showed you what to do. You're tired of living.
said, time's wasting, you've got a chance. You'll make the grade, no time for last place money. Oh, hot money. Now you don't know how to give yourself till somebody showed you what to do. You're tired of living on the same old shelf. Come on, honey, open up, I'm sure you're gonna see through. Honey, oh, honey, I said time's wasting, you've got a chance. You'll make the grade, no time for last place, honey. Well, honey. Now school time's over, I'm a willing man. Don't try to be so funny. You're bigger now, well, I'll be damned. I always knew you were hot, honey. Yeah, well, honey. Whoa. Time's wasting, you've got that chance. Honey, whoa, hot honey. The time's wasting, you've got that chance. Honey, whoa, hot honey. Oh, you'll make the grade.